This is PCJ Radio International. This is PCJ Radio International.
It's 1330 UTC. I'm Andy Sennett, and coming up on this edition of Focus Asia Pacific, Burma's president vows to release political prisoners, foreign journalists might be allowed to enter Indonesia's troubled Papua provinces, and exports and imports in China fall. Burma's president, Thein Sein, has vowed that all political prisoners would be released by the end of the year. He made the commitment in a speech to a London-based research institution, Chatham House. Kanaha Sabapathy reports.
President Thein Sein is the face behind the reforms that have changed Myanmar from an international pariah to a poster boy for democratic change, has taken his commitment a step further by vowing to release all political prisoners by the end of the year. In England for a two-day official visit, Thein Sein had come under pressure from Prime Minister David Cameron to speed up reforms, especially in the area of human rights. In his speech at Chatham House, President Thein Sein also outlined the reforms he has enacted and for the first time admitted that after 60 years of repression, the country's institutions still remain weak, with the military still dominating society. He acknowledged the international community's concerns with NAPIDOR's handling of the violence against the minority Muslim Rohingyas and with the ongoing conflict with the rebel ethnic groups. But he was optimistic that peace agreements with all the ethnic rebel armies will soon be achieved and that the disbanding of the NASAKA, the security force behind the rights violations against the Rohingyas in Rakhine State, will address the issues of human rights violations. Abu Tahe is the chairman of the National Development Party and is himself a Muslim. He says the disbanding of the NASAKA alone is not sufficient when the issue of ethnicity and citizenship for the Rohingyas are not addressed.
Restriction imposed on Rohingyas for 20 years still remain unaddressed. So there are around about 700 people arrested in their first violent started in St. June, but not yet released. So that is not good enough to protect minorities.
Under the 1982 citizenship law, the Rohingyas are not recognized as an ethnic community, are seen as illegals from Bangladesh, and often referred to as Bengalis. Ong Tu Nien, the director of the Wahu Development Institute, a think tank dedicated to policy research and advocacy, says the violations against the Rohingyas cannot be addressed until the citizenship law is reviewed.
Just recently, the Burmese government disbanded the NASAKA. But, you know, they may have some human rights violation against the Rohingya. But as far as I learned from the Burmese government media, they see no reason why the groups has been disbanded. Another problem is, you know, the citizen law. There are kind of a contentious debate between the groups, you know, what kind of the citizen law should be in the country. So I think as long as we haven't tackled such a citizen law, you know, there will be problem continuing to be in the country.
In his speech at Chatham House, Thein Sein did obliquely speak about changes to citizenships without making any direct reference to the Rohingya issue. But as Professor Monique Skidmore, Pro-Vice-Chancellor at the University of Canberra, says, in a country where the political institutions are still weak, the military and state apparatus dominate and rule in the provinces independently of NAPIDOR.
That lack of a civil space for civil society, we still see the military, the security forces, so prevalent in communities. Not so much, you know, when you're driving around the capital cities, not around NAPIDOR or Yangon or Mandalay, but certainly out in the minority areas, you're seeing enormous numbers of security forces, and they're still very much governed locally, and they have very tenuous links back to NAPIDOR.
Professor Skidmore says, while Thein Sein in his speech did attempt to address the human rights concerns raised by the international community, he remained silent on the growing communal and religious violence between Muslims and Buddhists. Only last month, NAPIDOB banned Time magazine for its report on Buddhist monks stirring up violence against Muslims. Professor Skidmore says the government is now reaping the seeds sown by the former military regime.
During the years of the military regime, the state sponsored monks and created a particular form of politically active monks that were very, very nationalistic. And in some ways, they're reaping now what's been sowed over many years. And it is very possible for the government to change the way in which monks are admitted to monasteries, to change the way in which they give speeches, to stop them from travelling around the country, releasing this kind of anti-Muslim propaganda. But they're doing very little about it.
Indonesia's Foreign Minister, Marty Natalegawa, says he believes foreign journalists should be allowed to report from the country's troubled Papua provinces. International media are effectively banned from reporting freely within Papua, where separatist groups have been waging a struggle for independence for about 50 years. Mr. Natalegawa says lifting restrictions on foreign media could improve the Australian public's perception of the conflict, but he says it will take time to gain enough political support for the move. The Indonesian Independent Journalists Alliance says unless there is a policy shift, Indonesia could see its ranking on the World Press Freedom Index fall significantly. Richard Ewart asked Victor Mambor, chairman of the Papua branch of the Indonesian Independent Journalists Alliance in Jayapura, if this was just talk from the minister, or will it be a reality?
But before 2 years ago, as Marty said, there's seven journalists was deported from West Papua, and I don't know why they were deported, but as far as I know, they have a problem with the permit, yeah, because the Indonesian government say they have a problem with the permit. But as I said before, the Indonesian government has no formal regulation about it. Yeah, I never seen the regulation, the formal regulation. I mean, like Indonesian regulation, which will apply to stop the foreign journalists to enter West Papua. So it's like the gray area in West Papua, because the Indonesian government can use the situation to stop international journalists to enter West Papua.
And what more do you think an organisation like yours, like the AJI, can do to bring about these changes, particularly now that the foreign minister, at least in Indonesia, is hinting that there may be change?
Yeah, we're still trying to push the Indonesian government to think together about this situation, because, you know, international community was pushed, was stressed, Indonesian government to open the access for foreign journalists to enter West Papua. But as I said before, we need to sit together with the Indonesian government and then looking for the regulation. If Indonesian government have a reason, like they always say about the security for the foreign journalists when they enter West Papua. So we need to thinking and to solve this problem, because I think the main issue here is not about the security issues in West Papua, I mean, yeah? Because we can report everyone everywhere when we want to go there. Yeah? So the main issue is not about security in here, but the issue is how the Indonesian government looking for this situation here. I mean, the fair situation in it, because the problem is when Indonesian government closed the access to enter West Papua, the information from West Papua will look like a bad situation here.
Chinese officials have warned of a grim outlook for trade as the world's second largest economy registered a surprise fall in exports and imports in June. The data release follows a further downgrade of global growth by the IMF. Strong growth in China has helped power much of the Asia-Pacific region's performance in the past decade, including Australia and New Zealand. With the economy slowing, there's more pressure to conclude a free trade agreement between countries in the region. Karen Snowden has more.
In a telephone conversation with Prime Minister Kevin Rudd, China's leader Xi Jinping said that Australia and China should secure a high-level free trade agreement as early as possible. The widely reported remarks might be carrying a message to China's negotiators, as much as to Kevin Rudd, that the bilateral relationship is on track. However, James Riley, lecturer in politics at Sydney University, doesn't expect the 8-year-old talks to progress much. He says with Kevin Rudd back in the chair, Beijing is keen to set a positive tone.
Certainly the last time we had a Rudd administration, things were very poor in the Australia-China relations. So I think this, in this regard, is an effort for them to start afresh with the second round of the Rudd administration. And I think that's what that represents more than any specific short-term sort of opening in regards to free trade negotiations.
More immediate stress is likely from the softening economy. China's trade surplus declined 14% as exports fell by 3% and imports by 0.7%. Analysts were expecting both to rise. A spokesman from the Customs Department, which released the figures, said the outlook for trade was grim. Weak overseas demand, rising labour costs and the strong currency will continue to impact. But Eric Fishwick, head of economic research for CLSA in Hong Kong, says a crackdown on fake invoicing depressed both May and June export data, making them hard to interpret.
So the figures aren't quite as bad as they appear. Exports are not slowing as rapidly as one might think from looking at the comparison with the first quarter. But certainly the export environment internationally is weak. China is now quite an expensive place for a manufacturer to operate out of, and it appears that Chinese manufacturing is performing perhaps a little bit worse than its Asian peers.
Manufacturing isn't contributing so strongly to China's growth, which Eric Fishwick puts at a low 7% for this year.
I think there is a clear shift in policy with the new leaders. There is much more of a focus on improving the quality of growth. And if that implies a short-term economic slowdown, then there's much more tolerance of that short-term economic slowdown than we might have thought.
Because it'll deliver in the long run, you're saying?
Because it'll deliver in the long run, because it's more sustainable, and because it implies less build-up of credit and less build-up of risk in the banking system.
The International Monetary Fund has lowered its forecast for global growth from 3.3% to 3.1%, trimming its estimates for Europe, the US, China and other emerging economies. The Australian dollar fell on the China data, reflecting concerns about its demand for commodities like iron ore and coal. But even with his much lower 7% growth forecast for China this year, Eric Fishwick is not pessimistic about the impact on Australia.
So we typically look at Australia's exports, iron ore in particular, as being driven entirely by Chinese construction spending. That's only partially true. Those sorts of exports are also geared into a general manufacturing growth cycle. And I would hope that manufacturing in China and in other industrializing economies will be stronger in 2014 than 13.
Meanwhile, Beijing and Washington have their heads together in the important economic strategic dialogue. They appear to have come out even on the thorny issue of cyber hacking and security in the first session of its kind ahead of the main discussions. A bilateral working group and more cooperation on cybersecurity were discussed, according to the official Chinese media. Less productive might be market access discussions, where the US accuses China of not delivering promised reforms. Equally thorny is Chinese investment in the US. Sydney University's James Riley says there will be few concessions.
For the Chinese side, again, I think it's going to be hard to see where China is going to make a lot of concessions to the United States in regards to the market access. And I think there's a lot of frustration in China with regards to the US response to Chinese investment. Again, the issue with Europe is important because I think Chinese are feeling there's been a little more welcome and more appreciation of some of the Chinese investment in Europe, as well as here in Australia. And so here again, I think it's unlikely we'll see major Chinese concessions to the United States in that regard.
And with that report from Karen Snowden, we end this edition of Focus Asia Pacific. For more information on these and other stories from the region, check out our website at www.pcjmedia.com/FAP. For PCJ Radio International, I'm Andy Sennett.
A funny thing's been missing from air travel recently. It's called customer service. And it's not just about saying, welcome aboard and see you again soon. It's about understanding why you fly. It's about the hundreds of hours of training we go through before we even step on board a plane. It's the way we prepare the cabin and each other before every flight. It's about how we say hello. Whether it's the 30th time you've flown with us or the first, we are over 10,000 strong in 90 destinations around the world. We are China Airlines, and we blossom for you every day.
This is the sound of PCJ.
Well, good morning, good afternoon, and good evening. Welcome again to another edition of your program, Happy Station, from PCJ Radio International. And as always, it's very nice to have you with us on this Sunday. Now, today we're going to be doing a little bit of traveling, because many of the letters that we get in from people want to know a little bit more about Taiwan. So today's show, we have recorded on location in the city of Tainan, that at one point, during the Dutch colonial era, was the capital of Formosa, which was the original name of Taiwan. So we're going to be visiting Fort Zeelandia, which was the governor's house and the capital, which is an absolutely fantastic place. I really would suggest that if you come to Taiwan one day, I would love to bring you there. And what is unusual about it is very Dutch. Even today, it is still very Dutch indeed. In fact, some of the street names have the original street names, which are Dutch street names. But we'll tell you a little bit more about that in a moment. But we're going to have our first piece of music today. And I thought we'd begin with a song that was recorded by a friend of mine back in 1968. He died on this date, July 21st, 2005. I'm speaking of well-known British singer Long John Baldry. I became a friend of Long John Baldry in the 1990s when we were both living in Vancouver, British Columbia, and we used to hang out every now and again. And since this is the 8th anniversary of his death, I thought we'd begin with a song. The song is appropriately titled Mexico, that he recorded for the UK Olympic team in 1968. Now, why are we playing this song, Mexico? Well, Mexico is a very popular tourist destination, and since we are doing a little bit of traveling, let's listen to the song Mexico by my good friend, the late Long John Baldry.
Just take my hand and come along with me. There is so little time to spare. There is a place I'd give the world to see, where the music's softly playing and the rhythm's gently swaying. Underneath the stars, a million bars, guitars are softly saying, Mexico, you got to be in so much to see in Mexico. Take it from me, yeah, you're gonna see the greatest show. Underneath the sun in Mexico, the love we had is just a shadow now. Why did we ever drift apart? Let's get away and start again somehow, where the music's softly playing and the rhythm's gently swaying.
underneath the stars in a million miles, guitars are softly saying, Mexico, you gotta be in so much to see in Mexico. Take it from me, yeah, you're gonna see the great show underneath the sun in Mexico. Mexico, the magic has begun in Mexico, underneath the sun in Mexico. Underneath the sun in Mexico, the magic has begun in Mexico.
My good friend, Long John Baldry, who passed away on this date, July 21st, in 2005. And that was a song that he recorded in 1968 for the UK Olympic team. Well, Mexico. Mexico, of course, is a very popular tourist destination. There are so many popular tourist destinations around the world that, well, we can do an entire series of shows about them. But I thought that today we'd go closer to our own backyard. We're going to be heading to the city of Tainan, which at one point was the capital of Taiwan during the Dutch colonial era. So this is what I want you to do. Close your eyes and just try to picture the description of this absolutely fantastic place. But to get there, we need to take the train. And the journey itself, if we took the regular train, would probably take around, well, around somewhere around 4-5 hours. But we're going to take the high-speed train and get there in less than 90 minutes.
Your attention, please. Train number 701 is now arriving at platform 1A. Passengers taking this train,
Martin Zonk, Harold Fredrickson de Wirth, Peter Notz, Hans Putzmann, Johann van der Berg, Paulus Traunis, Maximilian de Marie, Françoise Caron, Peter Overwater, Nicholas Warburg, Cornelius Caesar, and Frederick Coyette. Now, you're probably wondering who these people are. Well, they in fact were the last 11 governors of Formosa, otherwise known as Taiwan. They were the governors between 1624 and 1662. In 1624, when Martin Zonk became the first governor of Hong Kong, previously the administration for Formosa was actually controlled in Indonesia, otherwise known as the Dutch East Indies. In the early part of the 1600s, the Dutch constructed a place called Fort Zeelandia, which became the main government here in Formosa as it was known at the time. What is quite extraordinary about it is the Dutch rule in Taiwan is actually only a few years compared, let's say, with the time that they spent in Indonesia and other places. But nevertheless, the sentiment is quite different here. This was a main trading point between Europe, China, and Japan in the early part of that century. The city itself is located in a place called Tainan, which is in southern Taiwan, which is a very unusual part of the country because most of the economic development does happen in the northern part of the city. Now, we're standing actually right at the main fort itself. Now, it probably does look a lot different than it did
in the early part of the 17th century, only because there were a number of wars that did take place in this area at that time. So a lot of the fort was destroyed. Then parts of it were rebuilt by different colonial powers, for example, Japan, which replaced a lot of the damaged areas and put it with bricks. In the main outlook area, where actually you can see trees and some other buildings that look out towards the sea, which were not originally there, some of the original cannons from the Dutch period actually still exist. They look as if they were entrenched in water and then taken up. You do see some water rot in them, which is quite interesting itself. It's actually not as big as, let's say, forts that the Netherlands had in places like Indonesia and other places. Now, the military staff here at the time, it was actually quite small when you compare it to other areas. There was first probably around 100, and then the most that it went up to was maybe 10,000 at one period. But then because of conflicts in the Dutch East Indies, what today known as Indonesia, a lot of the military troops actually headed down towards that part of the world. So this fort actually in many ways was left sort of wide open for any type of invading forces. It's a rather big tourist destination today. Not far from this area actually are still some of the grave sites that were for Dutch soldiers, and the grave sites themselves have been rebuilt. The cannons actually are quite fascinating. I think the stands that they're on are probably not original, but they're of course made of cast iron and steel, and I think it would have been kind of impressive to see these cannons in their day doing their job. Now, just at the beginning, I mentioned that, Formosa had 11 governors. Now, only 10 of them were Dutch. In fact, the last governor of Formosa was actually from Sweden, of all places. Yes, Sweden. The land that gave us IKEA and Volvo. So you kind of wonder if it was a Swedish thing of what happened here, and the military didn't do so well. The fort itself, as I said, there's a watchtower, and oddly enough, the design of the watchtower itself looks slightly like an air traffic control tower that you'd see in an airport. It's the strangest thing, so I kind of wonder if they thought when they were designing it, oh, maybe one day there'll be aircraft or something. The fort itself, you still see some of the original ruins that were not refurbished after the war of 1664, but I think, of course, if you were to do anything with it, it would probably destroy the characteristics of the place. So I think actually the perfect time now would be to head up all those steps up to the watchtower itself, and to give an idea of what those governors and, what they saw here in Tainan at that time. This is PCJ Radio. I'm Keith Perron. We're on the road today in Tainan.
Hij slaapt, graaft en draaft met geweld om ons goed en ons bloed en onze steden. Hoor de Spaanse trommel slaan, hoor Mara's trompetten. Zie hoe komt hij trekken. Bergen te bezetten, bergen.
On today's edition of the program, we're visiting Formosa, otherwise known as Taiwan to the rest of the world, and known as the Republic of China, to a place called Tainan, or Anping. Now, Tainan originally, for around 38 years, was the capital of the island. The capital actually changed a number of times over that period, but this is actually one of the capitals. Now, this place actually had a few names. One of them was Orange City, of course, because of the Royal Dutch House of Orange, and then became Zeelandia, then became Tainan, and then became Anping, and now it's back to Tainan again. So it did go through some name changes. During the period that the Dutch were in Taiwan, like I said, it was very short, but it did leave a very long legacy. We hear some military aircraft actually flying above from the military. But the legacy that it left behind is quite unusual, because here in this part of southern Taiwan, people refer to Tainan under a few nicknames. They call it the Flatlands, even though it's not exactly flat. Of course, in reference to the Netherlands being so flat, they call it the Land of Orange. Yes, the Land of Orange. In fact, the official color of the city of Tainan is orange. And throughout the city of Tainan, you will find remnants of Dutch colonial rule, which is quite interesting because there's no other place in the world, or here at least in Southeast Asia, that I have come across similar things. I mean, in Indonesia, finding stuff left over from the Dutch colonial era is quite difficult. But here in Tainan, it is actually quite easy. A lot of the houses in Tainan look like houses that you would see in The Hague or Rotterdam. In the center part of the city, the original courthouse was based on a courthouse that was built in the city of Rotterdam in the 17th century. So it is very interesting indeed. Now we're going to go up to the watchtower area. Oh, I should mention actually what's funny, and I just noticed it right now. There's a little sort of cafe kind of souvenir shop. And there's a windmill and a couple of clogs outside, and you can buy wooden clogs and windmills. Yes, probably the only place outside of the Netherlands where you can buy that. And they also sell Dutch desserts. And also the famous Dutch French fries, which of course some Belgians would claim as their own. We're walking up the steps actually to the main watchtower area. Now, this part of the watchtower area itself was rebuilt after 1664. The original brick that you see here is not what the Netherlands placed down, but what the Japanese placed down much later on. The watchtower itself, this is the original mansion that was used also with more cannons on the main deck. When you stand up here now, of course the view is very different from what it would have been in the early part of the 1600s. When Martin Zonk, Formosa's first governor, came here. He was actually living in this exact same house. Beautiful Dutch design with a little bit of Southeast Asian flavor. All very well constructed, with of course the orange standing out quite predominantly in some areas. There's a number of trees on the upper deck. Trees actually, when you read, go back to the period of when Martin Zonk was the first governor, as well as the other governors that were here in Formosa at the time. The trees themselves are actually, oddly enough, from northern Taiwan. Now, at that time, the Dutch claimed that Taiwan was controlled by them. Well, actually, that wasn't the case, because Taiwan, or Formosa, was actually divided into two areas. Northern Taiwan was controlled by the Spanish and the Portuguese. Southern Taiwan was controlled by the Dutch. But they did have an alliance for a certain period. And actually, these trees all came from northern Taiwan. They were planted in, amazingly, 1623, just as the fort itself was being constructed. Absolutely beautiful design. I mean, it would have been amazing to see what it was like back in those days, what the feeling was like in those days, because you have the main house, the main mansion of the fort, and then you have what was probably at one time the garrison for the Dutch soldiers that were here during that period. So it would have been quite interesting to see the activity that was going on. Now, of course, when you look at it today, it looks very different from what it did in those days. The first thing that you notice, of course, are the amount of new buildings that have sprung up around the area, which, of course, were not of the original landscape. A temple which now lies at the foot of Fort Zeelandia. A number of new buildings, restaurants. And if you think, you know, back then, when this fort was built, the amount of nature that was around, it was just trees. It was just trees, including a number of Aboriginal communities, which had fought alongside the Dutch at the time. So, let's have a little music break, and we will continue with a look at more of this fabulous fort, the Orange City, the city of the Netherlands, Fort Zeelandia in Tainan, Formosa. And by the way, if you've just tuned in, you're listening to the International Happy Station Show on the road, this time in Tainan, otherwise known as Taiwan's Dutch city, the city of Orange, for a visit to Fort Zeelandia, a fort that was built at the early part of the 17th century in 1624 that housed the Dutch governor of Taiwan, who was here at the time by the name of Martin Zonk. This also happens to be his residence. Taiwan actually had a total of 11 governors. One of them actually wasn't even Dutch. He was, in fact, Swedish. We're now heading into the, you hear some echo, the watchtower itself. I'm not quite sure how many steps there are to the top. It does look like quite a lot. So you'll probably hear me wheezing for air during the course of this. It actually has kept to the original design. Of course, refurbishments had been done through the years, but they did try to keep it as original as possible. Down below, actually, at the foot of this building, which I described earlier as an air traffic control tower, there is also a guardhouse. Now, this here was the main watchtower for this area of the fort. And when you come up here, you could understand why they would have placed it in this area. You have a stunning 360-degree view of everything that is around. But, of course, it would look very different back in those days. Right in front of me, actually, at one point, I can see... here we go. This is actually the local airport, which at one point was farmland, a canal which was used for ships that were bringing goods from other countries that were part of the Dutch East Indies, China, for Europe. And then on the back side looks at New Tainan City, which is quite fascinating because you actually from here can see the graveyard that was constructed for the Dutch soldiers that died fighting here against China in the beginning, probably around 1660, and lasted a few years. When the Dutch actually left this area of Taiwan, they actually left the island for a short period, then came back through northern Taiwan and actually remained here for another 8 years. Now, from where I'm standing right now, as I said, there's a lot of houses that were probably built within the last maybe 50 years. But you can also see the original church that was built by the Netherlands. This church actually goes back to 1634.
Neemt hem mee. Hij is een schaduw in de mist, een schim uit lang verlopen tijd. Geen vrouw die op hem wacht, geen kinderstem die lacht. Heel alleen dwaalt hij met een spookschip door de nacht. Vliegende Hollander, eenzaam op zee, even gejaagd door storm en wind.
Standing just outside the main house that was the residence for each of the governors that was in Taiwan during that period. The house itself today has turned into a museum with a number of relics from that period, which is quite interesting. There's a couple of main busts of two of the people, actually, that led it, including the last governor of Ferdosa by the name of Frederik Koyet, who actually himself was Swedish. He wasn't even Dutch, but he worked for the Dutch East Indian Company. He died in 1687 after heading back to Indonesia. And I'm standing actually right now in front of the two busts, one for Frederik Koyet and the other for Kaushinga, who was the warlord who they signed the treaty with to hand over power. It's interesting actually when you look at it. The treaty itself was written in Dutch. There's actually an original copy at the Collection of National Archives in the Netherlands. It even has the reference number. So if you were to look it up, and there's also an original copy, because there were two copies that were done, also at the National Palace Museum here in Taiwan. I have to admit, Frederik Koyet, he doesn't seem to have much of a sense of humor. The trademark of the Dutch East Indian Company is everywhere, including paintings, including some of the items that they had imported from this part of the world to the Netherlands. And of course, you know, typical paintings from that period. Quite unique, actually, to look at it now, and you think that this was, at one time, the house of the last governor, or the governor's homes. When you walk into it, there's a big sign that says Dutch Formosa. And there's a map, actually, that shows the navigation routes for the Dutch, British, Portuguese, and Spanish ships. Also, quite a fascinating thing. The house itself actually had been abandoned for a number of years until it was refurbished. There's a painting that I'm standing in front of right now from 1975 that depicts this place, actually how it originally looked. This is before the watchtower was built. You see the main fort. This building that we're in right now hadn't been built yet. And then the surrounding houses. Now, the city of Tainan, as a city, was founded in March 1601. It was founded in March 1601. Now, the Netherlands had already been to Taiwan at that period, but it hadn't been established fully as a colony. It's actually funny because I'm looking at some of the names that I read earlier, with miscorrect spellings, and it's taken me a while, because I think what has happened is the names were translated from Chinese to Dutch to Chinese and back again. We're standing now in one room, which contains some of the original weapons that were used by the Dutch guards that were here during that period. Now, oddly, most of these weapons were not, most of them actually, when I look at the names on it, are actually not from the Netherlands. They're from France, they're from England, except for the cannons. These two cannons that I'm looking at right now were actually made in the city of Groningen in what year? In 1615. They were made in the city of Groningen. Quite fascinating, really quite fascinating. And then the other armaments, the helmets, the spears, the swords, are from France. And then if you look at the weapons that the Chinese had been using, you could understand why it wasn't exactly a fair battle. the swords that were used by the warlord Chinese forces were 10 times the size that of used by the Dutch. A couple of Dutch guns here, actually made in Rotterdam, in the early part of the late part of the 16th century that actually were sent here via Indonesia. Then, you know, when you see movies like, you know, Pirates of the Caribbean, you always have the treasure chest. Well, here actually right now is an actual treasure chest that was used for shipping goods. It's actually made in Germany. Quite a fascinating piece. An English oak press, you know, for printing. Also quite fascinating as well. In some parts of the museum, what you'll find are delf, you know, the traditional dishes that were used that period, all from Amsterdam and kept in immaculate condition. In this room as well is an armoire or a cabinet going back to Belgium. But actually, this is not really that old. This is only from the 19th century. But it's based on the style of what was here at the time. Quite a fascinating surrounding. I mean, it must have been interesting, of course, to see how this place was when it was a house. You know, you could walk all the way around it, and at one point here, I don't know if this door is closed. Oh, it's closed. But this actually, I'm standing in front of what used to be the kitchen. I was trying to look through the window, but it's... maybe we can actually look through the window, because the door is closed. And, that was a kitchen. It was a kitchen at one point. Quite a interesting surrounding, like I said. I mean, it is funny, because you think the Dutch were in Taiwan for a relatively short period of time. But yet, this legacy has stayed in the city for years and years after the Dutch left. When you walk around the city of Tainan, if you ever come to visit, if you're looking, like I said, for traditional Dutch delicacies, it is quite a easy thing to do. If you're looking for items that you would say find in tourist shops in Europe or in Holland, you can also find that here. So it is very unique, and I think this is what one of the things that makes Taiwan so incredibly special, because this is a land of so many different influences and cultural influences, not just from Southeast Asia, but also from Europe as well. To find influences from, of course, the Netherlands, Spain, Portugal, Britain is very easy. It is also easy to find, of course, many influences from Japan, because Taiwan, for a very lengthy period of time, was a Japanese colony. To find influences from other parts of Southeast Asia, Vietnam, the Philippines is also quite unique as well.
Ik zie een boot ver op het water. Niemand weet waarheen hij zal gaan. Vol op stoom, de tijd vliegt, het wordt alsmaar later. Er wordt op hem gewacht, hier heel ver vandaan. En in zijn hut leest hij de namen. Ieder kind, daar schrijft hij iets bij. Binnenkort, dan komen ze allen terug. december wat. Dat maakt hem blij.
Ronnie Tober with Naar Nederland, ending our visit to the Dutch historical city of Tainan, that was the Dutch government's base during the Dutch colonial era here in Taiwan. And if you go there, it is unusual because you can find some Dutch cuisine, which is interesting in itself, including some traditional Dutch souvenirs like windmills and clogs. I have to leave you right now, so until next time, so long, au revoir, auf Wiedersehen, adios amigos, and sayonara.
This is PCJ Radio International. This is PCJ Radio International. This is PCJ Radio International. This is PCJ Radio International.